Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Will Bunch will be on to talk about the conservative backlash movement we call the Tea Partiers. Also, Ken Cuccinelli makes a play to close down abortion clinics in Virginia, and people are talking about the pattern of young people growing up more slowly. There are many hilarious stories coming out of this election season, as in every election season. But for my money, this one might be the most hilarious. Ben Quayle, Dan Quayle's son and candidate for Congress in Arizona, was outed as a guy who wrote dirty stories for an erotica website under a fake name. He's trying to weasel out of it.
I have had nothing to do with that website that you just talked about. What this is about...
What about its predecessor? Let me just say something. It had a predecessor, too. What?
This was about a few posts, satirical and fictional posts that were put out on a blog that doesn't even exist anymore over 3 years ago, and it's been...
As usual, I'm torn. I don't like stigmatizing people for normal enough sexual behavior like writing erotic stuff. On the flip side, I don't like hypocritical politicians getting away with moralizing about others doing stuff they themselves do. The obvious solution is for politicians to stop moralizing on this stuff so that I can defend them with a clean conscience when it gets out. Cuccinelli. He's the Attorney General for Virginia, but he's also a man of high ambitions, and his preferred route to obtaining his goals is to be as conservative as humanly possible, which in turn means that he has the stink eye pointed in the direction of women's rights. In all the media chaos dedicated to chronicling the awakened and grumpy conservative obsession with race, Cuccinelli managed to break through and grab headlines by getting back to some old-fashioned beating on women's rights.
Straight off the top tonight, a new fight is opening up in the abortion debate in Virginia. The state's Republican Attorney General has issued a legal opinion saying Virginia has the right to place restrictions on abortion clinics. Supporters say it would increase patient safety. Opponents say it's aimed at closing down clinics.
As you can imagine, the supporters are lying. They are anti-choicers, and they wake up and go to bed with lies on their lips, so of course their feigned concern for women's health has nothing to do with this. They have two major goals. One, convincing the public that abortion is an evil procedure that is as dirty and scary as they claim it's immoral, and that the doctors who perform it aren't professionals. And two, shutting down abortion clinics. Considering that anti-choicers are, at the end of the day, demanding a legal regime that would stuff the hospitals full of injured and dying women who tried to perform abortions on themselves, I think their claims to care about women's health are not just ridiculous, but insulting. There is only one real stance for people who care about women's well-being, and that's to be pro-choice. End of story. Anything short of that is wishing injury and death on women for wanting to control their own fertility. The regulations Cuccinelli wants to impose by fiat instead of going through the legislation are ridiculous.
Friday, Cuccinelli issued a non-binding legal opinion that says Virginia would be within its rights to increase regulation of the 21 clinics located in the state. At issue is whether abortion clinics should continue to be treated like same-day surgery centers or dentist's office, or if they should be equipped like hospitals and emergency rooms.
There are 21 clinics in Virginia that offer abortion. The estimate is that 17 would be closed down by these regulations. There's no reason whatsoever to consider abortion a surgery that's serious enough to require hospital-level regulation, since it's basically done with no cutting and in about 5 minutes without anesthesia besides some pain medication. Oral surgery that is done in office is more dangerous. An abortion is functionally the same thing as a D&C, and Cuccinelli isn't going to require all doctors who do D&Cs, which are basically all gynecologists, to be subject to these same regulations. It's all an attempt to keep women from getting abortions. If you don't believe me, check out Rachel Maddow's coverage. Tarina Keene of NARAL Pro-Choice Virginia explained the issue on the show.
Well, if you think about your typical doctor's office, most of them are rented facilities, and they're very small. They're not hospitals. And if you had to retrofit an existing office, whether you own the building or you don't, you're talking about $1.5 to $2 million a year to, or I'm sorry, $1.5 to $2 million total to actually have that retrofitted to become a small hospital or what we call ambulatory surgical centers.
But the ugly truth is that Ken Cuccinelli is indifferent to things like facts and reality when these things stand between him and his ideological stances. Believing that abortion is somehow dramatically different than other minimal outpatient procedures, even ones that are identical to it, is just one example. Cuccinelli has also waged war on scientists for having the nerve to be right about global warming. He specifically sued a UVA professor who had the temerity to be right about global warming.
How interesting a political story is this? Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli throws what's become another political firebomb, demanding that UVA hand over documents and correspondence from a former professor to determine whether fraud was involved as the professor sought taxpayer-funded grants for research on global warming.
Luckily, Cuccinelli's legal harassment of an innocent man was seen for what it was, and a judge quashed it pretty much immediately. On the abortion front, all we have now is an opinion and a lot of press coverage, but no immediate reason to think Cuccinelli is going to get away with his war on women and doctors. But he's someone to keep an eye on, because clearly he's not a man who lets facts, decency, or the law get in the way of his vendettas.
I'd like to welcome Will Bunch to the program. Will is an author, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, and a senior fellow at Media Matters. He's got a new book out called The Backlash: Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and the Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And he's here to talk about his book and the Tea Party movement. Welcome to RealityCast, Will.
Hey, Amanda. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
As we're doing this interview, it's Tuesday. One of the biggest subjects of your book, Glenn Beck, has just finished up a rally in D.C. on the anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. Even though it's clearly silly, the teabaggers are claiming to be the real fulfillment of King's legacy, and basically that 95% of black Americans don't understand what Dr. King really wanted. Tea Partiers do this to feminism too, rewriting feminist history to downplay Margaret Sanger and pretending the suffragettes were anti-choice. My question is this: what's with this obsession with rewriting history? Why does Glenn Beck put so much energy into historical revisionism?
Well, you know, what I found when I was researching this book, The Backlash, is that there's this craving among the rank and file of his movement, this predominantly white middle class, mostly over the age of 50 movement, I want to put it in quotes, quote, learn, unquote, American history. What I found is these are people who are experiencing enormous anxiety, and I guess there's a number of sources, but there's two main ones. One is cultural, and this great fear that of watching America become an increasingly more multicultural nation, and these studies that have shown that whites could even be a minority in this country by the year 2050 or earlier, and I think that's looming culturally on the back of people's minds. There's also a lot of economic anxiety that's affecting all of us, and it's affecting these people. Particularly a lot of people are from the Midwest and the South, in areas that have experienced heavy layoffs. So there's a lot of fear out there. And there's a lot of anxiety, and I think I think this is what these are the things that are motivating these people in that direction to look at these issues.
Yeah. On the economic anxiety front, this is a big question I've had. Like, obviously Obama came in inheriting the worst recession since the Great Depression, and there's been a lot of suggestions that so much of this over-the-top conservative backlash has just been about economic anxiety, and that perhaps those of us who are deeply alarmed by this should feel bad for the people that are doing this. Do you think that if Obama was elected in good times, economic good times, this would be less severe than it is?
I I think the economic anxiety is a contributing factor, but it's not the main factor. I think the cultural anxiety that, as you imply, would have still existed even in good economic times is really the major factor. And I feel that the economic anxiety is an overlay. You know, one way the economics, I think, does impact this is, you know, so many of the people I interviewed in researching this book are people who are prematurely unemployed, they're underemployed, they took early retirement, they, you know, perhaps they're homemakers and their kids are out of the house. These are people with a lot of time on their hands, and they spend that time immersed in this 24/7 conservative media bubble in absorbing these messages. The stereotypical Obama voter is younger, working a job or two, perhaps in their child-raising years, and, you know, don't have time to get home at 5 o'clock to watch Glenn Beck, whereas these people do. And I think, you know, I think their economic problems are causing them to have more time to listen to more of these fearful messages and to become more anxious. But I think underlying all of it, I think, you know, I think the cultural concerns, you know, the fear of the other in America, whether it's a Mexican immigrant or whether it's a Muslim seeking to open a new mosque, or whether it's Barack, you know, whether it's Barack Obama, the first African American president in the Oval Office. I think these things are conflated in the minds of a lot of anxious people out there. Right.
And what I think is interesting is probably up until a month and a half ago, the mainstream media narrative about the conservative backlash was that the old-fashioned anti-choice, anti-gay conservatism didn't have anything to do with it. But Beck was getting all religious at this rally, and of course you have people freaking out about the Park 51 Muslim Community Center by the World Trade Center. And so I think that narrative is finally dying off. But what role do you think religion and social conservatism play in the Tea Party movement?
I think it's always there. I mean, even you're right, in 2009 when the movement first came up, I mean, the whole religion aspect was downplayed, and the fact that this was more of a libertarian type thing. A lot of these people aren't religious. I didn't find that. I mean, I found people who, you know, their first point would be about Obama and how he's not an American or he's not authentic. But then they would say, and the other thing is, this country really needs to get back to God. So I think that's always been an underlying message for these people. I mean, certainly, you know, when I went to the in reporting the book, I went to the Tea Party convention in Nashville back in February that Sarah Palin spoke at, and there were several major televangelists working that crowd, and there was plenty of prayer, and there was plenty of what you would have seen at any kind of Republican type gathering, or conservative, I should say, type gathering since the Reagan era. So,
do you think that the notion that this was kind of a secular movement came more from the conservative movement themselves, or was something that was imposed on it by the mainstream media?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the media is always looking for a new angle. I think when the first Tea Parties came out and the primary talk was, to the extent was that they want government out of people's lives, they want virtually no government spending at all, it seems like. And, you know, I think that was a new angle for the media, and I think that got played up. But I think the Christianity is always there. I mean, certainly it's a big part of what seems to be going on in Glenn Beck's mind. And, Glenn Beck, a lot of my book is focused on, or not a lot, but, a quarter to 30% of my book is focused on Glenn Beck because he's been such a powerful force in that movement. And, Glenn Beck is he doesn't have a political plan. He's doing his shtick as an entertainer. And, I think he's really consciously modeled himself after some of the great televangelists, where he's becoming kind of this Elmer Gantry type figure. And he's got this emotional bond now with his 3 million or so followers over the TV, and we'll see how many people follow him, but some will.
Yeah, I find it kind of interesting the way that he references himself as a recovering alcoholic all the time.
Right, right. And he's very steeped in the 12-step approach and the 12-step movement. And if you have to watch some of his longer speeches, as I did when I spent 7 hours at his American Revival event down in Orlando, Florida, I mean, he really falls back on that. But, you know, I mean, what he does best is he entertains and he appeals to emotion, though. And I do think that's something very important that speaks to the political zeitgeist, if you want to call it that right now, is that Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and some of the others are playing on this emotional playing field, and you know, that the progressive movement and President Obama and his organization believe that rationalism will win the day. And I think that was a powerful argument in the 2008 election, but now in 2010, you know, I think we're seeing a game of, you know, not rock, paper, scissors, but rock, scissors, where emotion is the rock and is kind of crushing this kind of unemotional, rational approach to politics that Obama keeps going out there and pushing. So I think that's very dangerous, I think, for the progressive movement right now.
In your book, I think it's really interesting. You spend a lot of time discussing the importance of myths and paranoia to this conservative backlash. What's your feeling on the popularity specifically of the myth that Obama has faked his birth certificate and was really born somewhere else and can't be a citizen?
Right. I mean, this theory, which has just an incredible lack of basis in facts. I mean, you know, including the fact that, you know, Obama's birth announcement was printed in the small print in both Honolulu newspapers the day after he was born. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to this theory. But what it speaks to is, you know, the cultural anxiety I talked about earlier, and this kind of innate belief that to this group that when they started seeing Obama on the rise in 2008, that somehow they felt that this guy was not an American, and that was their emotional feeling. And what's interesting is they tried to look for quote facts unquote that would back up the way that they felt, you know, which was that when I see this guy on the TV, I feel like he's not an American. And, you know, and of course, and the reasons they see that are, you know, largely the extent of race. I mean, although I think there's also, you know, you find a lot of resentment of Obama among this group because he's an elitist who went to Harvard, and so he's got all those things going for him. But I think race and the fact that he, you know, that his father was a Muslim from Kenya and some of these other things, you know, have just stirred up this feeling that people feel threatened by the idea that the guy in the Oval Office is somebody with this kind of background.
It's interesting to me because the notion of being born here or there and that legitimizing you has become such an emotional theme in politics, because you not only have the birth certificate obsession, but you also have this new obsession with so-called anchor babies. Do you discuss this freak out over immigration much in the book?
Oh, absolutely, I do. In fact, I spent some time in Arizona, and there's a whole chapter on that. And it was really just as SB 1070 was coming on the radar screen. And you know, absolutely. I mean, there's a direct line between the anxiety over Mexican immigration in a place like Arizona and the anxiety over Barack Obama. I mean, these people are. The people animated about both of those things are the same people I found when I was down there. And in fact, a lot of people who were leaders in this kind of hardcore nativist movement, and I'm talking about people who, you know, go down to the border on the weekends with guns and try and, you know, prevent people from crossing over. I mean, a lot of these people raced to join the Tea Parties in 2009, and a lot of these people raced to support J.D. Hayworth against John McCain in 2010. So you're really talking about the same people, absolutely.
And even though Arizona's kind of getting the worst of it, I was recently in El Paso and I didn't even see a tenth of the ugliness that you're seeing in Arizona. They weren't able to compel their candidate to beat John McCain. So what do you think of that? Are they just sort of limited in how much they can do?
No, I don't actually, because I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the thing is that John McCain and you know, whatever you think of McCain and the way he ran his candidacy for president. But I mean, the bottom line is he was somebody even after the election in 2008 who had potential to be, you know, somebody who could be something of a deal maker or some kind of compromiser. I mean, he, you know, for years he had acknowledged the existence of global warming, for example, and something that needed to be done for it. And for a long time in his career, he was not really too far away from the Democrats on or from liberals on immigration reform. And when the minute he was challenged by J.D. Hayworth, everything changed. I mean, he dropped immigration reform and he dropped climate change and he even flip flopped on don't ask, don't tell. So I mean, he just moved to the far right on a number of issues. So bottom line, I've argued that in Arizona was mission accomplished for the Tea Party and for the far right, in that they didn't have to elect J.D. Hayworth. I mean, they basically got John McCain to do all the things that J.D. Hayworth would have done if he'd been elected.
My guest today has been Will Bunch, and his book is called The Backlash: Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. It's out in hardback, and it's available at local bookstores and online. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Will.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed it, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
So, a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times had an interesting magazine feature on the not-really-that-new theory of emerging adulthood. This was something that caused a lot of whining when Generation X was young and out of jobs and delaying marriage, but now that it's the millennials that are doing it, you're seeing a little more sympathy for it. Still, I fully expected when the Today Show covered the phenomenon that it would be in a negative light. This is especially because while the economic factors that are making it so that people in their 20s put off certain adult responsibilities, there's also an element of choice, especially sexual choice, as their expert Jeffrey Arnett explained.
Well, there are a variety of reasons. The economy has changed for one thing, from a mainly manufacturing economy to a more an information and technology and services economy. That takes longer to prepare for. Another reason is that now premarital sex and cohabitation are widely tolerated, if not exactly accepted. So there's not the same urgency to enter marriage as there was 50 years ago when premarital sex was taboo.
Mm-hmm. While lifting the taboo has multiple factors, I think it's important to understand how much effective contraception and the belief that women have a choice dramatically changed what age people get married at. The old model, where you tried to delay having sex, failed, got pregnant, and married young, simply isn't in play any longer. Contraception allows people to have many years, often decades, between when they first become sexually active and when they get married and have kids, if they do that at all. Even if people do have accidental pregnancies and have the babies, they're less likely to feel like this means that they have to get married. The result of all this is that people have the freedom to make mistakes and learn lessons in a lower risk environment, which is why the divorce rate is lower than it's been in decades. In general, I don't see this trend as a bad thing, even if it means some living with your parents. It gives people time to get an education and find out what they really want to do, and it minimizes the damage of youthful mistakes. What did surprise me was that this was what the panel on the Today Show also thought.
One of the things that you pointed out earlier is that their brains are really not developed until they're 25 years old.
Well, they continue to develop. So that whole adage that, you know, once your child's a teenager, that their brains are done developing is over. That from an impulse control, decision making, really regulating emotions, that can continue until they're 25. So it's an extended adolescence. At the same time, we expect them to make these adult decisions.
Right. So you're saying really that biologically, this makes sense, that prior generations didn't have a choice about when they sort of took on the responsibilities of an adult. Today's generations might have that choice, and if they do have that choice, what's wrong with it?
Nothing's wrong with it. It's interesting because all this change in how adulthood looks is, I believe, what's fueling a lot of the sex panic in the anti-choice movement. A lot of older people want to believe that something is wrong with all this because it's different than what they expected growing up. And frankly, they're a little jealous and resentful that young people might have more choices. The result is a mishmash of impossible expectations. They wag their fingers at young adults and tell them not to screw around, but they still don't want those young people to rush into marriages, parenthood, and unfulfilling careers. They instead seem to think that it's possible for young people in an experimental phase of their lives to simply get through it without experimenting. It doesn't work that way. We should be glad young people feel like they can hook up or cohabitate while they're finishing growing up. It's simply better than the alternative of creating marriages that are usually destined to end badly after the growing up is done and the growing apart has happened.
Yeah, what's wrong with it? They generally make very good use of it. They do a lot of interesting things with their 20s. Things like join Teach for America, join the Peace Corps, try some interesting place to live or travel. They move to a different part of the country or the world to do something interesting for a while that they can only do while they don't have adult responsibilities.
He's speaking about a very privileged class of young people, But the emerging adulthood thing seems to be true in my experience of people who actually do need to draw income during these years because they don't have their parents supporting them. A lot of less wealthy young people still go through this phase of finding themselves. They flip through a bunch of entry-level jobs, maybe pay rent to their parents, or shack up with friends or lovers. Eventually, many of them find a groove. For our purposes, the important thing is that open access to contraception, and yes, even abortion, has made it a lot easier for them to be able to experiment without getting into a situation they can't discard without major consequences. And so when they are able to make more lifelong commitments, they do so with a clear head and an open heart, putting them in a much better position to be successful than if they were shoved into adulthood too young by an oops pregnancy and a shotgun wedding. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, the Teabaggers Are So Anti-Choice Religious Fanatics Edition. Part of the common wisdom around this conservative backlash is, as I discuss with Will, the notion that it's not especially religious or interested in traditional fundy issues like abortion or gay rights. Glenn Beck finally put the nail in the coffin of this narrative over the last weekend, making statements like this.
That's when Dr. Dobson said, "What kind of a hypocrite are we if we believe these things, but we don't say them?" And Dr. Dobson said, he looked me right in the eye, and Dr. Dobson is a guy who doesn't, you know, he doesn't agree on theology. And we have our theological differences. And he looked me right in the eye, just a real integrity and power. And he said, "I will start tomorrow. I will start tomorrow." And he did.
For right-wingers, this is a whole cloth thing. Racism, corporatism, nativism, and sexism are all part of one big shebang, and they aren't afraid to claim that they're speaking for God when they promote those odious values.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.